This is the Breaker.News podcast for May 27th, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, looking back at the Tiananmen Square massacre 29 years later, with Fenella Sung of the Friends of Hong Kong. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is the proposal for road tolls in Metro Vancouver all wrong? The good news, gas taxes may go the way of the dodo bird. The bad news, they may be replaced with even higher taxes if you need to drive a car to downtown Vancouver during the daytime. It could cost up to $12 a day if you're driving across the Lower Mainland in rush hour traffic, or as much as $2,700 a year in extra taxes to drive a car. That is, if TransLink's long-term funding idea ever gets a majority of Lower Mainland mayors and the provincial government to give it thumbs up. It has already been called political suicide. When he finished his $35,000 a month job as TransLink CEO in 2015, Doug Allen bluntly told the board of directors this, quote, "Road usage charging can only be used to increase transit ridership, not fund roads and bridges, if it ever gets implemented in the first place. Risks and challenges to the implementation are numerous on both the technical and the public acceptability fronts. Several orders of magnitude more complex than the Compass Card project," unquote. Remember the Compass boondoggle? It doubled in price to $200 million and took 2 years longer than it should have to make the high-tech fare gates work properly. What do you think? Email me, bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taipei Times, Yang Xuanwei reports, last snake-only shop closes on Huashi Street. The last snake restaurant in Taipei's Huashi Street Night Market, also known as Snake Alley, is to close, with second-generation owner Kuo Yi Chen saying that the shop is to be converted into a hot pot restaurant. 6 decades ago, Huashi Street in the city's Wanhua district was a red light district that featured brothels, street performers, and snake meat restaurants, said Kuo, who inherited his father's restaurant, which has only ever served snake. There were as many as 8 snake restaurants in the area's heyday, but the only 2 other remaining restaurants with snake on the menu now mainly sell soft-shell turtle meat. In the Otago Daily Times, David Fisher reports, Chinese Communist Party link claimed. An influential United States Congress hearing has been told, one of the major fundraisers for Jacinda Ardern's party is linked to the Chinese Communist Party, and it showed China had penetrated New Zealand's political networks. As a result, U.S. lawmakers needed to consider whether New Zealand should be kicked out of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance because of problems at its political core. The bombshell testimony included claims from a former CIA analyst that anything on China that was briefed to Bill English was briefed to Mr. Yang Jian, the national MP revealed last year as having trained spies for China. In the Anchorage Daily News, Annie Zack reports, McCarthy's only ambulance was vandalized, so a Wisconsin tourist bought the town a new one. Jonathan Dobbs was visiting McCarthy, Alaska last fall from Wisconsin. While leaving a bar, he saw a flyer outside. It showed a picture of McCarthy's only ambulance and a plea to help find whoever had vandalized it and rendered it unusable. He heard that the small northern Wisconsin town of Plum Lake, about 14 miles from where he lives in Boulder Junction, was selling an ambulance. Dobbs and a friend, Randy Sams, drove the ambulance from Wisconsin to Bellingham, Washington. They put it on the ferry to Haines, Alaska. Then they drove it from Haines to McCarthy, where they arrived May 23rd. The community hosted a celebration potluck to thank the adventurers, complete with a cake with little ambulances on it, shown en route from the Midwest to the North. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle Times, Matt Day reports, Amazon closing 130-person Seattle delivery support unit, moving the jobs to Phoenix. Amazon is eliminating a Seattle team that supported the company's contract delivery drivers and is moving the jobs to Phoenix, where salaries start at about 75% of Seattle's minimum wage. About 130 people worked in the retailer's Seattle Central Operations Center, routing the drivers who deliver groceries and other items, according to members of that team. Earlier this year, the group was informed that the work was moving to Arizona by the end of June. An Amazon spokeswoman said that relocation of the Central Operations Center was a business decision unrelated to Seattle City Council's head tax on companies to fund social housing. In Czech news, Tess Van Straten reports, why did the Malahat closure last so long after the Goldstream crash? Traffic finally started moving again early May 25th on the Trans-Canada Highway after a fuel tanker truck and a courier van collided, leading to a staggering 14-hour closure. Main Road Contracting was responsible for handling the chaos that ensued as thousands of stranded drivers struggled to find another way in or out of Victoria. Environmental and safety concerns were the main reasons for such a long closure. The crash happened just meters from the Goldstream River, and officials were worried the fuel leak could damage these salmon spawning grounds. After the RCMP investigation, which took priority over the environmental emergency response, the tricky and dangerous job of trying to drain all of the home heating fuel and gasoline from the Fast Fuels tanker then began. And in the Portland Tribune, Jim Redden reports, Portland home prices lowest on West Coast, but still high. Portland has the lowest home prices of any major West Coast U.S. city, according to a new analysis by Property Shark, a national real estate blog. But the analysis finds Portland home prices are higher than practically any other city in the country, except for those on the Northeast Coast, and in many cases, the differences are striking. The analysis released on May 22nd compared how much square footage $200,000 U.S. will buy in major cities across the country. The average in Portland is 773 square feet. That compares to just 260 in San Francisco and 525 in Seattle, the next largest figure. Portland's total is also much higher than the national lowest of 126 square feet in Manhattan and the 451 square feet in Brooklyn, the largest of the major northeastern coastal cities. And also this week in The Breaker, we reported that Attorney General David Eby is facing a BC Liberal-backed tax revolt in his Vancouver Point Grey riding that threatens to derail his work to bring law and order back to BC. And hundreds of concrete segments made for the Evergreen Line SkyTrain were rejected, but the dozens that were installed are at risk of cracking and expanding. The BC government's project director says they're covered by an extended warranty and subject to regular inspections. And finally, Jas Paul Singh Uppal, 21, turned himself into police in Abbotsford, who then sent him to Mississauga, Ontario to face aggravated assault charges. Ranjat Dami and Parm Chahil are also charged with beating an autistic man at a bus station on March 13th. That's Cascadia Calling for this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It's the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Springtime came to Beijing in more ways than one in 1989, but it didn't last long. For more than a month and a half, students, intellectuals, and workers descended on Tiananmen Square in central Beijing. It is regarded as the symbolic center of China. They demanded that China become more democratic and more transparent. They wanted freedom of the press. The protests swelled. Even Russia's Mikhail Gorbachev, the man who helped end communist rule in the USSR, visited Beijing during the protests. The world was watching. But then it all came to a bloody, tragic, violent end when the People's Liberation Army cracked down on June the 4th, 1989. This is what it sounded like when Tom Mintier reported live from Beijing for CNN.
This is the center of Tiananmen Square. Before it fell, just before the troops moved in. You see the goddess of democracy, the statue. The students set fire to buses and anything else they could to hold the troops back, but nothing held them back. Brute force and mechanized armor crushed through the barricades they put through, and the automatic weapons fire felled the protesters who stood in their way, as they were to have their way on this night.
Thousands of people died. State censors made it the biggest, dirtiest secret of the Chinese Communist government. Before she came to Vancouver, Fenella Sung was a journalist with RTHK in Hong Kong during the 1980s. The translator and former Fairchild radio host is the convener of the Friends of Hong Kong. She sat down with The Breaker to talk about the ugly legacy of the Tiananmen Square massacre, why it should never be forgotten, and what it was like during the spring of 1989 as Hong Kongers prepared for China to take over.
Most people around the world at that time, we've been watching the events unfold. And I think to many of us who've been China watchers for decades, it came really as a shock to us, because as we see China starting to open up during the 80s, I think no one would have expected that the army would turn their gun pointing at the students, at civilians, peaceful protesters. And all they want is just to demand for to end corruption, a cleaner government, a fairer government. They didn't even bother to say that, like, no, we want elections or whatever. It's just that they want a cleaner government so that their life would be less harsh, less difficult, so that it's more equality among different classes. All these are very, very modest requests. And I think it's really sad as we look back today that the very same kind of modest requests are still happening. But we see the regime haven't changed a bit, or even getting worse and worse. And what is even alarming for us around the world is that we see those kind of corruption, those kind of disregard of human rights, the so-called China model that they've been trying to export right now, that there's no level playing field even in terms of the business circles, the defiance of international ruling, like in what's happening in the South China Sea. We see those kind of trends that happened way back 29 years ago in 1989. Actually, it's still happening, or even is getting worse and worse, and exporting those kind of corrupted nature or those kind of evil things around the world. So I think the rest of us, we really should be aware and be alarmed as to what's happening right now, and as to think that what's happening inside China won't affect us here in Vancouver or here in Canada today. Actually, every minute what's happening there, as what you rightly said, actually it has ripple effect around the world, and including us here in Vancouver.
There were two major events after 1989. First, the 1997 handover of Hong Kong to Beijing, and then the 2001 International Olympic Committee's choice of Beijing to host the 2008 Summer Olympics. That led to China becoming an economic superpower. But the transition later of Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping did not bring openness. There is a whole generation of Chinese people who are kept in the dark about June 4, 1989.
I think what is particularly of interest to the rest of the world is really the 2008 Beijing Olympics, because everyone has been recognizing that as the kind of welcome party of China to be admitted into the world in terms of both as a superpower as well as part of the international village, so to speak. But unfortunately, after that, we see those kind of things really not to our expectation. But I think, looking back, I think it's really many of us has been looking at China with a rosy eyes, really, that actually there were signs telling us that things are not really what it seems to be to us, to the rest of the world. I always remember, I don't want to talk about theory or whatever, but I just want to look at it from a reasonable person's point of view, just use common sense, is that We remember when we were young, our parents would tell us, like, you know, if you want to decide or to choose a trustworthy friend, you don't look at how he or she deals with the other people. You just look at how they deal with their own family members. Then you know if that person is reliable or not. And I think that really holds true if we look at whether a nation or a government is trustworthy in terms of business dealings or adhering to international negotiations and contracts. It's when we look at how China has been dealing with its own citizens for decades. We would have known that, you know, they are really double-faced. I mean, they are really just for expediency that they are dealing with the Western world or the other countries in a way, particular way, but just for their own thing and also temporary. The real nature is not like that. So I think that really is a wake-up call for us to, especially here in Canada, in the past little while, we have those kind of big events coming in, and we had this talk about the free trade agreement with China to open up furthermore about our significant or even strategic sectors to the China market for their investments to come in. I think we really have to look at who they are, their nature, instead of just what they do or what they say, because there are many, really many facets about China that we don't know. So I'm not saying that about contain China, so to speak, or not to engage with them at all, because it's a reality that is a superpower, that no matter how we do things, we still have to engage it. But in what way? I think we have to be very prudent and wise, and also we have to take it one thing at a time. We have to always bear in mind that there are many things about China that we don't know, so better find out more before we make those kind of strategic moves.
The Chinese Communist government is tightening its grip over the country. It has increased surveillance in the Muslim province of Xinjiang. It is trying to exert more control over Hong Kong and Taiwan. And, through sophisticated international propaganda, it is seeking to influence how the world sees China. The Bentall cluster of towers in downtown Vancouver and the Retirement Concepts chain of seniors' homes were both sold to Anbang Insurance, but the CEO was recently jailed for fraud. Last week, in a surprise move, the Trudeau Liberal government of Canada rejected the next big takeover attempt by China. It rejected the Chinese takeover of Aecon Construction for reasons of national security. I asked Fenella Sung for her reaction to this surprise announcement.
I think personally I am pleased with that decision. I think it's a good decision that they put a stop to the Aecon takeover. Because it's really, you know, from all aspects of it, many sectors, including those in the technology sector, in the intelligence sector, and the U.S. government, really, you know, our strategic trading partner, they all have warned our Canadian government of not to take that move. So I'm personally pleased with that, but I still take that with caution, because there are so many different decisions and so many takeovers and so many, as what you say, so many Chinese capitals coming into Canada in all sectors, in all aspects of our life. And in terms of education, in terms of mining, in terms of oil companies, agriculture land, real estate, not to say that. So it's really, when they are becoming a part of you, how are you going to get rid of them? And how are you going to say that, where is the fine line? I mean, when they have become part of you, when their capital has become part of our economy and like the real estate sector. I was told that the real estate sector here in BC, the sales volume and the figure actually is even larger than our mining and forestry and the oil sectors, all three combined. It's really scary. It's really scary. So, you know, you have to support them in order not for them to fall, because then your economy won't fall. So I think it's a kind of late awakening to me, that they only realized it now, but late is, of course, is better than nothing. But I'm just thinking that we cannot take that as just a kind of one-time deal for election purposes. Like, we know the Ontario provincial election is coming up on June 9th, and there's a Quebec by-election coming up on June 18th. We don't want the federal government to think of all these just for election sake. We want them to think of it really strategically for national security purposes. And not just for security, it's really for the overall balance and the healthy growth of our economy. You cannot really put all the eggs into one basket, or you cannot rely on one country. Like we used to say that we cannot rely just on the U.S. economy or trading with the U.S. We have to diversify. But right now, we are just taking the easy way, it seems, that we are trying to replace the U.S. money with the Chinese money. Then why don't we just diversify? So, you know, and make the Chinese money or the Chinese investment just one out of the many, then we will have a lot more leverage power, I think. But as I say, like, you know, where are you going to draw the sand and say, when they have the compound of you and say, oh, I won't allow you to touch this, I won't allow you to touch that. Very difficult.
That was Fenella Sung, convener of Friends of Hong Kong in Vancouver. She's a former journalist with RTHK Hong Kong from the 1980s. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the police detectives and British Columbia Provincial Court Judge Jean Jameson, who brought Andrew Leach to justice. The drugs and guns gangster was sentenced to 16 years in jail. Kim Bolin reported that the Coquitlam convict sold 50,000 deadly fentanyl pills in a year. Too many people have died from drug overdoses, and not enough of the dealers have been arrested and jailed. We must take notice when that does happen and congratulate law and order for doing their jobs to make our communities safer. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for May 27th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on May 27th in 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge opened to traffic? Well, now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.